God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Trish from San Clemente.
Hi, my name's Trish, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Amy for coming with me and Linda for sitting up here. Thank you so much. Nice to have friends in the audience. And I want to thank Catherine for calling and inviting me to speak and for welcoming us at the door. And I think that's it. Thank you for just having me here tonight. And I'll just tell you a little about myself. My name is Trish. I'm an alcoholic. I think you'll agree with that by the time I'm done with my story. I didn't drink quietly in the closet. Everybody knew I needed to get sober. Everybody. I think the bus driver that picked my kids up from school knew I needed to get sober. And I turned 13 this year, so I have 13 and a half years of sobriety. I'm pretty impressed with that. I'm amazed. I was amazed when I had 17 days of sobriety that I had gone that long without drinking. And I came in here when I was 44, and I started drinking when I was about 15. So I drank for a very, very long time, and it got really progressive. I drank like they talked about in the book, you know, and just when everybody would be like, oh my God, she must be done, I just went on and on and on. I mean, it was insane. So I'll do, like our program asked, tell a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in California, not the kind of California that you all know. You're in San Clemente, not the beach and the sun. My dad was a nuclear physicist, and he worked out on a naval base called China Lake. It was out in the middle of the Mojave Desert, and that's where we were all born and raised. And it was called Naval Ordnance Test Station back then, so they tested missiles out there. And a lot of our schools had bomb shelters underneath them, and we would just sit in class, and like our windows would shake, and you know they'd be out on the range testing out there. And I remember when I was in eighth grade, our eighth grade student body president and his friend, they stole liquor from their parents' canteen. And one of the kids' name, his nickname was Bozo because he had these really big ears. And they got drunk on the way to school, and then they went like the cafeteria and they got locked down in the bomb shelter. So we're like all sitting in our classrooms and we could hear like this, help, coming up from the heater. And it was them. And so they got caught and they got suspended, and Bozo's nickname became Bozo. And that was it. He was no longer our ASB president. But that's how we knew that those bomb shelters did exist, because some drunken friends went down there. But it was really a nice life. We lived on the base. The civilians got to live on the base. And then everybody's dad worked over at Michelson Lab. And I remember a real sense when I was growing up, most of our dads were like the first one in their family to have gone to college. And because they had gone to college, they had all become a scientist or an engineer or a physicist or something. And their style of life became incredibly better. And so that was something that my parents always, I mean, all the kids I grew up with, our parents really promoted. You're going to do well in school. You're going to go on to college. There was that sense of that where I grew up. And so I always knew education was really important. I love to read. I love anything that takes me out of myself. Usually it's not good things, but reading did pay off. But I mean, I love to read, and because it would just like take me out, and I would literally like go out of this world. When I was in like second grade, we used to get these like little worm sections for every book that you read, and mine like obsessively wrapped around the room, you know, like 10,000 times. I would go to the library to check out a book, and I would open, take the little card out, and I'd already read it, you know. I mean, I just love to read. So anyways, I started off to school. I was a good student. I wanted to get really good grades. My first experience with drugs was when I was in fifth grade. This is my first big lie that I told. For years, I thought this was going to be the most tragic event that ever happened to me, but I didn't know that I was going to become an alcoholic and create way more chaos than this little event. But I was home from school babysitting. It was really hot. I wanted to go up to the Officers Club swimming pool that day, and my mom was getting like her teeth pulled out for some kind of root canal or something. So I was babysitting little baby asleep in the crib, and then my other little brother. And I was sitting on the couch playing with matches. And I was like writing straws on fire and watching Let's Make a Deal. And I dropped one of the matches and I caught the couch on fire and all the clothes that were folded on the couch on fire. And I also caught myself on fire. And so I like ran to the bathroom to put myself out in the shower. And my mom had removed all the shower knobs because my brothers and sisters would get in there and like turn on the hot water and scald themselves or whatever. So then I tried to take my nightgown off, which caused me to severely burn myself. I have third-degree burns. I still have really bad scars down my side. And then finally, I remembered in Girl Scouts, like, we rolled in the dirt. So I ran down the hallway and rolled in the dirt, but I was on fire for a pretty long time. And so I called my dad. He only had one car. And my dad came home, and I told him, like, well, I was cleaning the house, and he told me never to, like, throw matches away. So I lit one match because I was going to blow it out and then throw it away in the trash can. And then this happened. And, you know, and oh my gosh, I mean, I was in so much pain. You could see my ribs, and I was in the hospital for a while. And but I got all these, like, Girl Scout awards for knowing what to do. And I was, like, written up in the paper, you know, young girl saves herself from fire. And I'm like, I'm a little liar, you know. I mean, you know, I was playing with matches, and I didn't want to tell the truth. But my mom said that when I used to go out there, because I used to have to go to the doctor every other day, and they would cut the bandages off, and then they would pull it off, and then they would scrub the, because it, like, burned all the way down. You could see my ribs, and so they had, like, no infection. So my mom said, the doctor used to give 3 prescriptions for Valium. He took one, my mom took one, and I took one. We all drove out there, and it really set up a real insomnia. So that's what I remember coming into my life during that time period. I couldn't sleep at night. It was very painful. Every time I would roll over, I would hit it. Got to know all the other kids in town who had played with matches and caught on fire, you know, kind of on the burn ward. One girl would commit suicide because she caught her face on fire from lighter fluid. And, you know, it was, you know, and I still have a scar to this day. But anyways, so that was my first introduction to drugs, and when I started not sleeping at night. And I would sit up every night by the streetlight and read books and kind of got through that. And my first big lie that I told that I got away with, you know. So I think I got away with it. But anyways, I moved on into high school. And, you know, I think my first drink that I had was at Dwight Scott's house. His parents went out of town, and everybody knew his parents were out of town. So we all went over there and had a party. And I drank Annie Green Springs, and I got really drunk, and I tap danced for the party, and they laughed, you know, and the party was on. And I drank like an alcoholic from the moment I drank. I don't think I remember that evening coming home. The minute I put a drink in me, from that moment on, I didn't have an off switch. You didn't know how the evening was going to end. And I kind of knew that about myself. I actually a lot of times would forbid myself from drinking because I knew if I had an important event to go to, I probably shouldn't drink one night. Because if I took one, I wasn't going to be able to stop. And I actually changed our theater tickets because we had, like, Friday night theater tickets, and my husband would take me out to dinner, and we'd have 2 drinks, and the craving would be so bad in the movie theater at the Performing Arts Center. Like, I couldn't get through the performance unless I brought my own bottle. So I changed it to matinee tickets so we could just go get the damn play over with and then go drink for the rest of the afternoon. You know, because I couldn't, once that alcohol got in me. So I had my first car accident from drinking when I was 16. I asked my mom if I could borrow the car. They were going over to the officers' club to play bridge. My parents told me no, and I took it anyways. And went out, picked up my boyfriend, and we all went out drinking, and then I dropped him off. And I was driving home, I think it was down 395, and I was turning left into the back gate. I was going down the road that went out to Trona, turning onto China Lake from Ridgecrest, and I turned left right in front of a semi-truck. And he hit me broadside, and then I was, like, so drunk, I fell, you know, underneath the steering wheel, and then he hit me a couple more times, and the accident stopped when he finally hit a telephone pole. And so there was, like, a China Lake policeman, a Ridgecrest policeman, and a highway patrol. They're like, oh, my God, we got an accident. She's DOA. And I'm crawling out. I'm not DOA. I'm over here. And, you know, they called my parents. And I'm telling the cops, I'm not supposed to have the car. Can I just drive it home and park it in the driveway? Tell my mom the neighbor in it. And my mom came out. She's like, oh, my God. I could hear her, like, across the way. My daughter, she's dead. I'm like, I'm not dead. I'm over here. She's like, I'm going to kill you. And I'm like, wait a minute. So anyways, and you know, this is how hospitals have changed, because they put me in the hospital and I was with one of my girlfriend's dad who was in there having surgery, and we ordered out pizza and wine every night. We smoked in the hospital. I mean, I was having a great time in there. And I didn't want to go home. I had a little fear in the back of my head, like I knew I had been drinking that night. I told my parents I didn't wear my glasses. That was why I had the accident. But I was really, I knew when that ticket came, they could have charged me with drunk driving. They didn't. Another one I got away with. They grounded me for the rest of my senior year, but, you know, because I had totaled the car against permission. But anyways, that, you know, that was kind of how my life went. And you just kind of go, oh, that was bad. I left town when I decided to go to college the same way. I was a lifeguard. My whole family were swimmers. I was a strong butterfly swimmer and a breaststroke swimmer. I told my, another one of my resentments, I had big broad shoulders, I'm a little skinny girl. But anyways, we all swam. That's what you had to do in the desert. It was hot out there. And my brother, who I'll talk about later, qualified for the Olympics at Jimmy Carter, canceled later on. But we were good. We spent our whole summer swimming. And so I was lifeguarding over at the Officers Club pool and then ready to leave for college, you know, that week. And my parents had a bunch of their Air Force friends were home for the weekend. And the cool thing about growing up on a Navy base was that the enlisted men's club, they would let you drink if you were 18, if you were a girl. So that night, I borrowed my sister's white pants without asking her, kind of like the car that I borrowed, and I went down the enlisted men's club. And I had been having really bad headaches, so the doctor put me on Valium. So I go down the enlisted men's club, and I'm mixing cherry slow gin with Valium. And pretty soon I pass out on the floor. And my mailman walked by, and he said, well, okay, I'll deliver her home. I know where she lives. And he gets like a young cop in town, and they drive me home. And here my parents are having like all this company, you know, staying with them from town. And they're like, you know, she's drunk. And I just walk in the house. My pants are pink that belong to my sister. I poured cherry slow gin all over them. And I just climb right out the window, and I go back to the enlisted men's club while they're all talking. So my parents turn around. I'm not there anymore. You know, my dad, the enlisted men's club, won't let me back in. So my dad comes down to get me. And I'm just like I always am when I drink. I'm like, he gets in the car, and I'm like, let's go for pizza. And he's like, do you know who I am? I don't care. I'll pay for my half. You know, I mean, I'm just wasted, you know. So anyway, you know, my family was not pleased. So the next couple of days, they took me down to college, and I went where any good drunk should go to school, San Diego State. I'm like, whoa, you know, co-ed dorm, sorority, you know. I had no idea Mexico was down there. I mean, my family still, I mean, I grew up in China Lake. You can't see anything with the Mojave Desert. I called my mom. I'm like, why did you have me take 40 years of French? How come somebody didn't tell me Mexico was right here, you know? She said, maybe you should have taken geography. So anyway, I'm down there in a sorority, parting away, you know, getting good. I mean, and I actually did get really good grades when I was down there. My reading paid off, but I really quickly became known as the drunk in the sorority house. It wasn't uncommon for me to wake up in my sorority room and I'd wet the bed or gone a little too far, or maybe I woke up in a fraternity house, or you know whatever. And they were stunned. They had like a steak and beans night in the sorority house, and I, like, if you like got above a 3.5, you got to eat at the steak table, or below you had to eat hot dogs and beans. And they're like, Trisha's at the steak table, you know, like, because I have the reputation of being the sorority drunk. And it went on like that all the way through college. My parents had some troubles, and I ended up paying my way through my last 2 years of college. So I waitressed, and I worked hard, you know. And I left college the same way I left my hometown. I was got engaged to a Delta Upsilon, and we were going to have a big sorority fraternity wedding to end our college years. And we decided to go to San Felipe, and our moms all said, please don't go, you're like having a wedding in a month. And we went anyways, and we were in the Miramar bar, and everybody wanted to go home, and I didn't. So my brother-in-law grabbed me and pulled me up on his shoulders, and then he tore all the ligaments in his knees, and I went off his shoulders and off the second-story balcony, and I landed on the pavement, and all the concerned fraternity and sorority friends came down. They're going to get arrested on the sidewalk. They throw me in the van. And I wake up the next day, blood coming out of my ears, black eyes, a broken nose. And they're like, wow, we should get you to the hospital. So they took me back up to San Diego, and I had a fractured skull. And, you know, it was great. And my soon-to-be brother-in-law is one door down with his knee all in a cast, and our moms are calling me, told you not to go. So this described my drinking, if that hasn't described my drinking already. I'm irritated. I don't want to be in the hospital. It's spring break. So I have to go for an outside opinion because they want to x-ray my head again. So do you have anybody that could take you over here? Sure, I do. So they give me a pass from the hospital, and my sorority sister comes and picks me up. Now, she's dressed in a nice dress, but I'm in my hospital gown with a little opening, and I've got black eyes and, you know, the whole nine yards. So they take me, and they x-ray my head, and the guy comes out and he goes, yep, you have a fractured skull. You're going back to the hospital. You'll probably spend a week there. So we get in her little car, and I'm going, let's go to happy hour. Like, I want to go back to that hospital. So we go into, you know, Aspen Mining Company, and I get hammered there, you know, shots and shots, and I'm like so drunk. I see a guy that I had like broken up an engagement with, you know, and I'm like, I know you're all bummed that I left you. I mean, can you imagine what I look like? I'm in the hospital gown, black eyes, you know. I know. Anyways, so he contacted me on Facebook recently, and I asked my sponsor, do I owe him an amends? You know, he went through like the whole story, and you know, I wrote him an amends, but I started thinking about all the stuff I did after I broke up with him, and I wanted to say, you are so lucky I called off our engagement, man. You dodged a bullet. You have no idea. But I just made my amends. But anyway, so she brought me back to the hospital completely trashed, you know, and the doctor's yelling at me, if you hadn't been drunk, you wouldn't have gone off that balcony, you know, I mean, you know, you wouldn't have lived. And I'm like, yeah, you're right, if I hadn't been drunk, I wouldn't have gone off it, you know. So a couple weeks later, we all got married. All the people went out to China Lake. And, you know, my mom gave me her cross. And it was made, I think it was like melted down, like her mother's high school ring. And it had my grandfather's Korean ring. It was like my grandfather made it for her. So she would have something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. So I got to wear that on my wedding day. And you know, everybody drove up from San Diego State. We had this great big party. I drank burgundy wine. I got so wasted that they had to carry me to my hotel room completely. I mean, my dress was covered in burgundy wine. The veil and everything, the train was completely ripped from being carried through the asphalt parking lot. And just hung over. I think my poor mother-in-law's over there, like, you know, she's Catholic, she's doing all her. And, you know, a couple weeks later, my mom calls me, and she's like, where's my cross? You didn't leave it in my jewelry box, and I had no idea where it was. I didn't even remember that I'd worn it, you know, much less lost it, you know. I mean, that's the kind of things that, you know, I'm sorry, I'll buy you another one. You know, you can't buy something like that. So I came down here. I moved to San Juan Capistrano, and I got a job in teaching school, because I sound like who you want with your kids. and around that time, I had a brother, the one that I was describing that was such a good swimmer. He got arrested at a Peter Frampton concert for selling fake acid and when he rolled up. So he started getting in a lot of trouble, and my parents had sent him away to go to college, and he got jaundice, the stuff that turns you yellow. And so they were planning on going on their vacation. I think I'd just been teaching a year. And they asked if they had been planning this vacation forever. It was like a 6-week trip across country. So they asked if he could come down and live with me and get a job. And then he was going to start swimming over in Saddleback. And then my other brother was going to come down, and they were going to go to school and swim over here. So I didn't really know what to do. I wasn't 22, 23 years old, but I'm like, all right, you can come here. And so he got a job down here, got a job as a security guard in a hospital. He had a problem with drugs, and I didn't even know I had a problem, you know, much less what to do with him when he had a problem. And so my parents went on vacation, and about 2 weeks after he was here, I got a phone call at 4:30 in the morning, and it was from the Orange County coroner's office, and they wanted to know if I knew this young man, because he had been doing the rounds at the hospital and had broken into a medical cabinet and had administered himself adrenaline. And we think that he thought he was giving himself speed, but it gave him a heart attack and he was dead. And so my sister and I had to go down to the morgue and identify my brother. And then we had to sit around and wait for my parents to call, because there were no cell phones back there for the young people. And They were in Niagara Falls, and they called, and I had to tell my father over the phone that his oldest son was dead and they needed to come home. And that changed my drinking a lot. I mean, it was like fun partying until then. But then I got two constant feelings that really invaded my life until I came to AA when I was 44, so 20-some years of drinking after that. Half of me felt extremely guilty that I had not taken care of my brother when he was there, that if I had known the right thing to do or if I had taken his condition seriously, he would not have died while he was at my house. And, you know, it felt like it should have been me that should have gone, and it was awful. And the other half of me felt like if my parents had really loved their son, they should have canceled their vacation and mortgaged their house, and they should have put their son in rehab or someplace and not left him with their 23-year-old daughter. So I vacillated between those two experiences for the next 23 years of my drinking. I couldn't sleep at night. The insomnia got worse, and it was horrible, horrible. It changed the dynamics in our family, you know, and to sit there and tell my father that his son died while he was with me, and to watch my dad cry, just, you know, I mean, it made for a hard relationship for us for a long time, because I felt like I'd really let my dad down. I don't know what I could have done. I mean, I didn't really know. I didn't know a lot of the stuff I got to learn when I came to AA about this disease. I found out I was pregnant right after that, and so I didn't drink for a while, but I had my son. And I couldn't even stop drinking then. I would come home from school and we'd have bowling night or something, and I couldn't wait for the babysitter to get there so I could drink. I got my first DUI on my way home from bowling. I called in less than plans to a substitute from the Orange County Jail. You know, I'm sick tonight, I won't be in. And my drinking just progressed and progressed. I ended up leaving my husband, I'd like to say, because we had issues, but really it was because I met another guy at Shooters, you know, and convinced my, you know, and here I am with a little 2-year-old boy, and I break up my marriage, and, you know, just, and I'm teaching school like this, you know, and I buy this big 5-bedroom house, and I get a bunch of roommates, and I'm raising my son in that, and I make sure that I have custody to where he's with me during the week, but with his dad on the weekends, and he's gone during the summer when I'm on break. Basically, alcoholic joint custody, you know. And, you know, I remember one time I had parent conference, as we were just talking about this tonight, and everybody at my house was going to the Angel game. I'm like, I can't go. I have parent conferences. Just go to the game and don't drink. I can't do that. Finally, they talked me into it. So I went to the game and talked me into it. Like, that was hard. But I went to the game, and I remember having a couple beers, and I had a couple shots. And then we were going disco dancing, and the next thing I dream, my girlfriend Jackie's waking me up on the front lawn because the principal's taking my class into school because I didn't show up at work today because I'm passed out on the front lawn at my house. And I knew that before I went to the Angel game. I knew I had parent conferences that day, and I better not go out and put one drink in my system, because once I put one drink in, the switch is on, and I don't care what's happening next. I can't stop. So that went on for a really long time, and eventually I met another guy. I met him at Shooters as well. Matter of fact, we got our grandkids the other night. They were like, "You met in May, and you got married in November. Yep, in the same year, 6 months, start to finish." And we got married, and life calmed down a little bit. You know, I started being a mentor teacher for my school district and getting really involved. And I told my husband, "No more cocaine." You know, I think that really mixes with my career, and which it did get better. But really what happened was we got a pretty good life. He had a son, I had a son. They were only 9 months apart. We set up a nice little white picket fence existence in Lake Forest. There was a lot of partying in that neighborhood, a lot of partying after we moved in. We organized that neighborhood and got them going. But my husband's ex-wife, the boy came and lived with us for 3 years, and she said, like, you don't have to pay child support, but I don't know, all this kind of stuff. But we never went to court and said we didn't have to pay child support. So after all that time was up, she went back and filed for back child support. And I'm like, that's not fair. You told us we didn't have to pay child support. She goes, but it's legal. And I got, oh my God, this huge resentment. Talk about a justified resentment. I mean, I don't care where I went. If you would be like, hi, Trish, how are you? Oh my God, my husband's ex-wife is suing us. And you know, I mean, I like couldn't let it go. I couldn't stop talking about it. I get in these fights with her on the phone that I think about something better to say. So when she called me back, I'd work into that direction so I could like give my little finger. I mean, I was like obsessed, you know. And we started working all these second jobs because they started garnishing our wages. and it was just a mess. And what happened was, about this time, I'm doing really well at school. I'm a mentor teacher. I worked on writing an application for a blue ribbon at a national ribbon school. I got to go to Washington, D.C., sit on the White House lawn, meet Al Gore, meet Bill Clinton, shake their hand. I'm flying home. I'm like, wow, where do you go from there? I went to my first mental institution in that year after that. I remember even screaming in the mental institution, look what Bill Clinton did, and he's still president. And they're like, well, you're in a mental institution, ma'am. It doesn't matter what Bill Clinton did. So really what started happening was my son wasn't doing really well in school, so they decided maybe he had ADD, and that my husband and I are working tons of extra jobs to pay all this child support and lawyers so we can go back to court and whatever. And so I thought I would try a little bit of my son's Ritalin, because I wanted to be 10 pounds lighter and just a little bit more energetic. And I don't really think my son got to take it for very long, because I liked it. And so I went to the doctor and I said, really, I think my whole family's ADD. We all need a prescription. So for a while there, I'm like walking around with these triplicate prescriptions, you know, cashing them in for everybody. And, my son and I watched an after-school special on TV, and it was about kids that were selling Ritalin at school. They were chopping it up and snorting it, and, you know, we're like, wow, who would do that? Mom, like 5 minutes later, I'm in the bathroom, wow, you know, and I went insane. I got this self-induced psychosis. I made myself crazy. And I would go nights and nights and nights without sleeping, 6, 7 nights, pretty soon I'm taking the furniture apart, and then... And the, you know, I don't know, I'm working on the school newspaper, and it's like taking me all night long to get like one line correct, you know, it was just crazy. And our house started falling apart, you know. I took a leave of absence from my school district, a job I loved. I never, ever went back, you know, because they gave me a 3-year leave, and I had neck surgery and got real addicted to pain pills, but and this outside issue, and I thought I was sober because I was like not blacking out anymore. And our house just got really chaotic, and my husband, we would fight, and then we would have these arguments, and then I would call the police because I'm the little school teacher, and then they would like come out, and I'm like covered in bruises because I've been moving furniture all night long, and you know, and they didn't know what to do. You know, there's an officer in Lake Forest that's had every one of us in the back of their cars. You know, my kids are upstairs selling pot because they're enterprising, and they've got a little sales business going on. So one of my phone calls that I made to the cops ended up with my stepson spending 30 days in juvenile hall, you know, because I wasn't thinking about me, and he missed his graduation. And at that point, my husband said, I'm out of here. I'm leaving. And so I went to Cook's Corner and invited them home, people there, home for a drink, and they moved in for 2 years. And it was like insane in my house, you know, and the cops were there all the time. And what happened was we got told that my dad had cancer. A lot of people on that Navy base got cancer with all the testing they were doing there. And I was told he had 2 years to live. And I couldn't sober up during that time. I was the only one. My dad was the most wonderful man. He used to drive down, move all those people out of my house. He'd turn the utilities on. He'd sit on the front porch and cry with those police officers. And what do I do? She was like our star. And now we have this mess on our hands. And I would try to get everybody out of there, and it was just insane. My dad's last Thanksgiving, I didn't make it home. I got up. I was going to go home. Took a drink. Took a few pills. Took another drink. Called, said, I'm coming tomorrow. I'm coming tomorrow. And then it became Sunday, and I didn't make it home. I think they were glad, you know. But, I mean, I knew my dad. My dad died in March. And I couldn't even drive out to his funeral. One of those people, I'd like to say lower companions, but I'd become one. They were living in my house in my nice little neighborhood where all my kids had grown up. You know, we'd become the, as my sponsor so nicely put it, the white trash of the neighborhood, because the cops are there all the time. And one of them drove me up there, and I walked into my parents' house. They were putting the video together for him, and I saw all my brothers and sisters and my mom, and they're in the kitchen that I grew up in, and they're all laughing, and I'm all, you know... And I just kind of got this, like, whoa, like this out-of-body experience, like, whoa, what have I become, you know? So I stayed kind of good during the funeral, and then my mom said, I need you to leave, you know, and I'd asked my husband to come up and come to the funeral. He said, I'm coming, but it's not because I want you back. I want to come and, respect your dad. And so after the funeral, I stopped, you know, I was kind of thinking, like, I don't know. Anyway, people in my house that are down here, they're selling off all my stuff because they're, you know, it's just a mess. So I come home. from the funeral, drive by the pharmacy, fill everything up, get some drinks, but it wouldn't work after that. I couldn't. And I called my husband and I played that my dad died card. Please, please, please take me back. My dad died. I'll go to rehab. I'll do anything. And he said, you know what, Trish, I love you more than anything, but I maybe have 20 years left to live and I want peace in my life and it doesn't occur when you're around. I don't want to be around. I've done a bunch of suicide attempts and he'd had to come down. I mean, I was in and out of the hospital 7 times from that kind of stuff. And he just said, I don't want to be a part of it. You know, I'm done. So I got all these, I'm just sitting around, about another week goes by, I've stayed up about 6-7 days, so I decide, the middle of the night, he has a girlfriend, you know, that's why he won't get back with me. So I drove down to his apartment, and right here off Camino de Estrella, and sat outside his apartment all night long. I was going to catch the two of them when they came out in the morning, and what happened instead was the gardener came along at 5:30, with the weed whacker. There I am in the bush. Hey! And good morning! So at that morning, I was just kind of like, you know, maybe it's me. You know? What a concept. Good thing. So I went back to, I'm just like, excuse me, sir. You know, I can't get out of the bush like it's a normal occurrence. And get in my car. And I drove over to South Coast Hospital where I'd been hospitalized several times. And I told them, you know what? All the craziness that's been cooking, they kept putting me on the psych ward side of that hospital, you know, the little gowns and you got to light the cigarette on the wall thing and in a padded room. And, you know, and I knew what drugs I wanted when I was there. I had convinced them with such a disrespect to all the people that do really have mental illness, you know, because I was really in there because I hadn't slept for days on end and I was alcoholic and I was seeing things and whatever, but I was self-inducing that. So I went and told them the truth. And he said, well, we'll put you on the chemical dependency side part-time because we're keeping you on the psych ward the other half. We're not sure. But anyways, and I called my mom. It was Mother's Day. Best Mother's Day gift I probably ever gave her. I called her and told her I'd been lying to her and I was sorry for all the chaos that I really, because my whole family, I was dragging them through this. I'm mentally ill and you're the cause of it. And I called my mom one time, high as a kite, and I left, you know, she called me up to say, is everything okay, honey? And I called her back, no, everything's not okay. When I was 2, you did this. And when I was 3, you did this. You know, the answering machine would go out, and I'd call back, and when I was 4, you did this. You know? My brother said they got home, they turned on the answering machine, they were like, oh my God. Went on for days, you know. And so I told my mom, actually, Mom, I'm an alcoholic, and on top of being an alcoholic, I've been getting the doctors to write me prescriptions, and that has made me crazy, and I'm down here, and I'm going to tell the truth. And she goes, well, is it better to be an alcoholic than mentally ill? I'm like, well, I don't know, but it's the truth. We're going to find out, you know. And those were the best words. I think the last lie I told was in that hospital. I don't know why, but they took me in to take a blood test, and I'm in that bathroom, and I'm like, I don't want my file to say I've got drugs in my system. So they had like some palm olive soap. I like added it to my urine sample. I come out and like all bubbly. I got a clean test here. You know? Of all the things I had to worry about, you know, what a weird thing to think about. But anyways, I stayed in that hospital, you know, for as long as they asked me to do. And I did everything that they asked me to do. I became really, really, really willing while I was in there, you know. And I'm going to tell you, after 5 years of that, you know, my school district had given me 3 years to kind of to get well and come back, and I had literally lost that opportunity, you know, and I loved that job, you know, and you come to in that hospital after, you know, all that time, I was like, oh my God, please tell me that's somebody else's bad dream, you know, and it wasn't. And then how do you stay sober and wake up with that day after day after day, you know, and I did, and I did all the things that they told me to do, and then I came home, and my husband and I, for a while, during all that craziness, had bought a little consignment store in El Toro, and it happened to be on Raymond Way, right next to the Raymond Way Club, and so we had this little consignment store, which is a crazy place to put somebody who's all whacked out on Ritalin, you know, and booze. I'm like, I'm polishing the silver, but I used to watch these people all go upstairs and go to these meetings, and my husband had to go to meetings, because when I kept getting him arrested, because the cops would come out and I'd say, Tim, he's abusive, you know. And so he got court ordered to go to AA, which is when he left me, you know. And so I didn't have fun feelings of it. But those people had been really kind to me. So when I came home, I didn't know what to do. I remember I came home on a Labor Day weekend and everybody was in parks and having picnics. And I opened up my door and the doorbell, the wires are all hanging out because I'd taken it apart. And it's just crazy, you know. And I'm like, what do I do? So I remembered that little AA club, you know, and I went back there. And they knew me. My husband and I used to have fights in that parking lot, you know. And he'd say, I'm leaving you. And he'd get in his car. And I'd be like, you can't leave me now. And I'd jump on his hood. And, like, all the AA people would be up there smoking and maybe yelling out the thing. You go, girl. You know, he'd be driving me to the parking lot. So I come walking in there like, oh, the girl in the hood, you know. But anyways, they were so kind. I remember this lady from New York. I'm, like, bawling. And she's like, quit crying and start praying, you know. And they just, you know, they just took me in, you know, and I started going to 6 a.m. meeting there, and I met my sponsor, and she started having me go up to Pacific Group with her on Wednesday night. I'd be like, why am I going to Wednesday, you know, driving all that way on Wednesday night? She goes, because you don't have anything else to do. I have family. Well, they're not talking to you, so get in the car, you know. And, you know, and I started going to meetings every night. And they foreclosed on my house. The police came out, the same policeman who had sat with my father, and they helped me get all those people out of my house. And then we lost our store, so we had all the consignment stuff in our house. All these people had left. The house was just trash, this house that my kids had grown up in. And I got a foreclosure notice, and I called my sponsor. I'm like, oh, my God, they're foreclosing on my house, and I'm barely sober. I'm sure I write him a letter. And she's like, you've been the white trash in that neighborhood long enough. Get out. Whatever day is on that notice, leave. And I was like, wow, a little rough. I thought she would, like, get me a lawyer that would let me stay there, like, for a little while longer. But that didn't happen. So all the people from AA came over, and they helped me move out of my house. We sold all that stuff, you know. And I'd be like, oh, my God, that's an antique. And they're like, well, it's a quarter today. We're selling it to that person. You don't have anywhere to go. You're homeless, you know. You know, and my son and I got an apartment. By this time, he's an alcoholic. He has 8 years now, and he was really pretty heavily into his sales business. So from that garage sale, I raised my half of the rent money, and he raised his half of the rent money in another sales manner, and we moved in. And you know, I remember people used to take me home from AA, and they used to say, well, your son's side of the apartment smells really good. And you know, eventually he got arrested while we were living there, and the police all came in and said hello to me and asked me how I was doing. And I started working my steps, you know. I started working those steps. I remember my sponsor wanted me to go back to work, and I'm like, I don't know where to go. And she's like, I want you to try to go back to teaching. And I'm like, what do I tell them? You know, I had this great teaching record, and then I was gone for 6 years. I mean, what do I say? Well, you know, I was really actually an alcoholic when I worked with you, but functional, you know, in my eyes, you know. But then I started taking Ritalin. I went insane, and I did, like, mental institutions and everything else. And now I'm sober, and I'm in AA, and I'm back. You know, what do you say? But anyways, we worked out the truth. You know, like, I left. I opened a business. Now I went back to teaching, and I started going for interviews, and oh, my God, I would walk on those campuses, and I would have those interviews, and I'd hear all the kids laughing, and I'd walk out in the parking lot, and I would, like, start crying in that parking lot. I felt so dirty and so shameful, all the things that I had done, and I thought I was, like, never going to get, like, that life back. And it was, you know, I appreciate so much when I go to speaker meetings and I see people in suits and dresses, because when I came to AA, I got to see that kind of stuff and hear that people were nurses and pilots and doctors and teachers, and they just had they had the disease of alcoholism. It hit every area of life. And maybe if I got sober and had a good way of life, maybe I could, you know, be functional in society again. And so it was September, and I hadn't been hired by any school, and I'm like, I told you no one would want me. And my sponsor said, maybe you're trying to get the promises before you finish your ninth step work. So I sat down and spent the whole month of September. I read the ninth step every day. And then I went through my ninth step list, and I wrote those letters. And I went and made those amends. My second mother-in-law, the one whose son I'd put in jail several times, they'd loaned us a lot of money. I called her up and asked her if I could come over and make her amends. And she said, I'm glad you're sober, but I don't want to see you in person. You know, you can mail the amends. So I mailed the amends, and my sponsor told me that the $30,000 that we had borrowed was not my debt, because I was the one that had caused all the chaos, and I could start paying her back. And I had to send her a letter with that payment every month, and I couldn't talk about myself. And those letters were excruciating. Hi, Gladys. Here's your money. How are you? I'll stay away from you. You know, I didn't know. But I mailed them every month, and I went and held my mom's hand and told her how sorry I was that I wasn't there when my dad died and how much I loved her. I remember, so I always kind of thought maybe my mom had, really thought that my mom had a drinking problem. And when she used to say, you need to go to rehab, I used to say, you need to be my roommate. When you're ready to go, I'll go. You know, I wasn't nice. And my sponsor said, you're not going to tell her anything of the sort. You're going to go make amends for the things that you did wrong. Your mother is older now. Her husband is gone. When you go up there, you change the light bulbs. You take her grocery shopping. You ask her how her day is. And you shut your mouth. And I'm so glad that happened. And I remember, and it was right. I remember holding her hand and looking in her eyes, and every amend that I made, I'd look them eye to eye, and I know I had a huge part in it. I was wrong. It was real. I brought a lot. And then it was really freeing, because I blamed all those people, blamed my parents for my brother's death, and making me responsible. And yet, when I figured out what my part was, I could change me, you know. It was useless to blame all those other people because I couldn't do anything about them, you know, but I could change what I was bringing to the table. So slowly my life started to get better. And, I got a little job answering phones and kept applying for jobs and kept making my amends to my son, you know. I mean, it just... My mother, my first mother-in-law, you know, I mean, that poor lady would go suicide, you know, she would take my son because I was crazy, and then because I would make a suicide attempt or something, and then I would come out and I would yank my son back out of her house and start it all over again, you know. And then she would go pick me up from the hospital and invite me over for dinner, and then I would just do it all over again. And I got to go and thank her for taking care of my son and apologize for all the chaos I brought to her and her son when he was my first husband. It was really a healing experience. And so I finally got a job at a school district. They wanted a math teacher. I was an English teacher. But I went for the interview, and they were able to hire me. They had a teacher that was leaving. I had kept calling around. I hadn't wanted to call my last principal down here because I just was afraid to tell him what had happened. I found out later on he was in AA, you know. But finally I called and got a letter. I didn't find that out from AA. I found that out from somebody who told me. And I got a letter of rep, and I went to that job. And it was at Christmas time, and they gave me the job. And they said, if you want to stay here permanently, you have to become a math teacher. And I'm like, I hate math. And all reasonable people. And but instead, at the age of 46, I applied to Cal State Fullerton. And I went back and I got a master's degree in math education with an emphasis in middle school math. I would be sitting there, I'd be like, okay, I didn't know how to live sober, and I sat in the front of the room, and I asked homework, I asked questions, and I did my homework, and I'm still sober. So maybe if I sit in front of the math room and ask questions and do my homework, I'd be like, God, who cares what X is? And then I would be like, well, you do if you want a job, you know, so it's kind of important. You know, and my mom got to live to see me walk across Cal State Fullerton and get that degree, you know, and that was really a neat thing. And the school hired me full time. I'm still there. And it's a blessing. It really is a blessing. And my first day on campus, okay, they have a lockdown. And I'm like, oh, my God, what kind of school did I come to? They have this lockdown, you know, and come to find out it was a drunk driver. The police pulled him over, you know, they're calling on the phone. And said, we have a drunk man on our campus, you know. And he, like, tried to run away from the cops, and he ended up on our campus. And they were like, you know, I don't know, it was like 2 hours arresting him. But I sat in that classroom and just said a little prayer. I thought, there, by the grace of God, go I. So grateful to be on this side and to be sober and get to be in these children's lives. You know, and my mom, she died unexpectedly. We went out to have dinner with her, and I got a call, and she had died in the middle of the night. She had just spent a week down here in San Clemente with us. It was so funny. She's telling all this. I sure like Trish since she's gone to AA. I see caller ID, and I pick up the phone. She's not like the rest of you kids. She asks how I'm doing and wants to know my life. My aunt goes, how funny, because you got caller ID because of her. You know, I'm like, oh. But anyways, you know, she got to see me graduate. She got to see me be sober. And I'm so grateful I never went to my mom and told her what I thought was her part or whatever. And my sponsor was right. Just to take care of my side of the street and being loving. What a difference to die when you're have a parent die when they're sober. And my husband, who I stopped and spent the night in the bushes, I would call him like every 6 months, I'm 6 months sober, and if you don't come home now, I'm divorcing you. He'd be like, okay, divorce me. I'd be like, well, I'll give you 6 more months to think about it. And finally, my sponsor said, let that poor man go, you know, because I would call mom and go, I put you through school and you got your teaching job and da-da-da-da-da, and you should keep my health insurance. And, you know, I'm just like holding the poor man hostage. So I let him go. I said, you know what, I'm ready. I'm sober. Thank you for keeping me health insurance long enough. And, you know, I really appreciate it. I'm sorry I messed up our life. And about 6 months later, he knocked on our little condo we had down here and asked if we could start dating again. And I was like, I knew you loved me. And, you know, I think he was scared. You know, his mom said the same thing, you know. When his mom, and I think he was scared to tell his mom that he was going to be seeing me again. You know, she wanted no part of me, you know. And, you know, it was interesting when his mom died because I got to go in the room and talk to her. She was dying and she gave me a necklace and some things that she wanted. She handed me back an envelope and she said, you know, keep doing what you're doing. I just didn't want to let you back in my heart, you know, and I'm so proud of you. And when I got home and opened that up, it was all the letters that I had mailed her all the years, and there's a little letter in there from her. So, you know, that direction in AA had really helped heal, too. So, you know, it's a good life that we have now in AA. You know, I don't know. We went to the convention in Toronto up at Niagara Falls. My husband goes, we're going to go to Niagara Falls. I'm like, I don't want to go to Niagara Falls. That's where my dad was standing when I told him my brother died. I really don't want to see that place. You know, it has bad memories for me. And he said, I don't know, those Canadians were pretty good to your parents. They got them home and they treated them well and kept their car for a month. Maybe you ought to go say thank you to them. So my sponsor used to always tell me, like, when you see a butterfly, they're winking at you from the other side. You know, so whenever I saw a butterfly, I should say a prayer and say hello to my brother. So we go to Niagara Falls, and I don't know, I'm really anticipating it. We come around the corner, we're just getting to Niagara Falls, and my husband goes, check it out, Trish. And there's this, like, huge butterfly farm, thousands of them. I just start bawling. I'm like, oh, he goes, I think you can let it go now. I think that's what he's trying to tell you. And I don't know if that's the truth or not, but I get to believe that, you know. There was something in my heart that opened that up, and AA has taught me to understand, you know, what was going on with my brother. I have an obsessive, addictive personality. My doctor told me, well, I don't know, a couple of years ago, you should probably lose 15 pounds. Your dad had diabetes in adulthood, and you could get diabetes. And I'm driving to work the next day, and I'm like, Christ, I have to quit everything that's fun. I quit smoking, I quit drugs, I quit alcohol, and I have to quit food. Good night, tasty food. And then I'm like, oh, my God, look at your perception of life. You perceive these things are fun, things that you do to excess that will kill you. That's probably not most people's idea of fun, you know, but that's my brain. And, you know, when I started teaching math, they also had me teach science, and I really love the science. It, like, ignited this passion in me. And so a couple summers ago, I'm working on my science credential now. I don't know why I'm going to retire in 3 years, but whatever, because I can do it, you know. And so I was over at UCI in this summer conference, and we were doing these experiments. Young, freckle-faced kid, you know, and he's like, check this one out. So they put ethyl alcohol into this tube, and it, like, eats the paint off something. And he goes, yep, first time I saw that experiment, I never drank again. I go, you never drank again? He goes, it eats the paint off of things. Can you imagine what it could do to your stomach? And I'm like, oh, well, actually, I can. you know, obviously, we're from two different sides of thinking. I was the science experiment, I get, you know. But, you know, and I remember getting really sad when I left there. I called my principal, and I'm like, I miss that whole life, like what that kid has, you know, that enthusiasm for science. And he's not drinking or alcohol. He gets to go pursue that, and I didn't get to do that. And she goes, well, get your damn science credential now, you know. But I had a different life, you know. God had a different purpose for me. And that is, I've come to see as a blessing in AA. You know, we have a primary purpose. That's to stay sober and help another alcoholic stay sober. Now, the crazy thing is I've ended up sponsoring a lot of girls. Girls go to me, and they go, I hear you were insane when you came in here, and then you changed a lot, you know. And somebody, and I'm thinking, like, who would think that would be a recommendation? But you know, I used to sit and watch those promises, and it would get to that part where we will not regret the past, and I would think, that's never going to happen. How would I not regret not being there when my dad died, or, you know, some of the things that I just described to you? But you know, we get to sit with another alcoholic and they share their steps and we get to say, I did that, or that happened to me, and there's a place in the steps where we'll take care of that. And then you get to have a primary purpose in life, you know. And for me, I'm not good at quoting books, but there's that line in the Bible that says something like, you see in the valley of darkness, may not see the light. You know, I was that person. I had to see the darkness before I could see the light in my life. I had a good life before I messed it up. A good job, a good home. But I was always complaining. Always, you know, then another drink. And, you know, but not anymore. I get to go to work. I get to be with those little junior high kids. I get to teach them math. I'm like, okay, kids, you know. I get to, and I always think that. My son, who's eight years sober, you know, he went out there, and I think God gave me that too, because I did everything that I thought my parents should have done. I mortgaged my house, and I put him through rehab after rehab after rehab. And the last time, 30 days later, he's driving away from Nancy Clark. We just saved him from a year in prison, supposedly. And he's high, and he's like, F you, Mom. And I'm like, what? You know, you can't buy somebody's way into sobriety. And that's what I realized with my parents. They couldn't have done that with my son. I got to walk through it. I had to detach with love, like my sponsor was saying. And you know, and a couple months later, he was on my doorstep. And he's sober 8 months now. He's going to have a baby in September, you know, Audrey Grace. And I just love that name, because that's what happened in our family, Grace. We got the grace of sobriety. I tell my son all the time, you know, I think it was us. Because since you and I got sober, it's really calm in our house. All those people we were blaming, I don't think it was them. So anyways, I thank Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank you for inviting me here on a Friday night. I'm very, very grateful to be sober, and I don't want to ever get far away from that gratefulness.